We have some very exciting news for you. The IAP Essentials podcast is starting to move towards some new and exciting content. To match that change, the podcast will now be called The Special Edge Strategist. We hope you continue to listen and find value in our podcast. Hello, and welcome to the Special Edge Strategist podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials offers special education-based support, educational therapy, academic therapy, and IEP coaching by state-certified educators with advanced degrees in all areas of special education. The Special Ed Strategist podcast brings professionals together to educate and empower families navigating special education needs and the IEP process.
Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, the pod that offers all things special ed. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. If you want more tips, show us some love on social at Learning Essentials. If you are new to our podcast, give us a follow. And this episode of Special Ed Strategist podcast, we are talking with Amanda and Vicky from the Inclusive Education Project. The Inclusive Education Project, or IEP, is a nonprofit organization that educates families on special education rights and connects qualifying California families with pro bono legal aid for special education and affirmative immigration support. IEP seeks to spread awareness of parent rights by providing parent workshops and seminars. IEP also fundraises through charity events to fund pro bono legal aid to California children and families that could not otherwise fund legal representation. They are here to make a difference, one child at a time. Thank you so much, Amanda and Vicky, for joining me today. And I'm really excited to have you guys on and to have a conversation, especially in this time during COVID, about educational gaps and parent rights and services and support to help guide families that are listening. So thank you so, so much.
We're ready. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, we're happy to be here.
You bet. So before we dive in, Amanda, could you just introduce yourself? And then Vicky, I'll have you introduce yourself. Give us a little bit of background and kind of what got you to this point and what got the Inclusive Education Project going.
Sure. So I'm Amanda Saloki. I got my undergrad degree in child development and thought I was on the path to becoming a special ed teacher, following in my aunt's footsteps. And I had the privilege of working at a full inclusion school while I was in college, working with kids with special needs, particularly one little boy with Down syndrome who just stole my heart. And, you know, along the way, I realized how much red tape there is for teachers and how much families and schools struggle with the system. And I just felt like it wasn't a good fit for me, that there was some other way I could help better. I was worried I was going to be the one to speak up and get fired, honestly. So I found out that special education law is an area of law, and I was always told I should go to law school. And as much as I fought it, it just kind of all clicked together. So I went to law school specifically to do special education law, and that's where I met Vicky. And, you know, a couple years out of law school, we decided the system is still, we're kind of fighting an uphill battle. And we thought we could do things a little bit differently. And we created Inclusive Education Project. And I'll let Vicky talk a little bit more about IEP.
Yeah, so I'll wrap up the IEP and then I'll give a little bit of background about myself. So with the Inclusive Education Project, we started it as a nonprofit really to be able to provide presentations and services to families that wanted to make a change but didn't know how. It quickly evolved into getting our podcast, Inclusive Education Project podcast, and then eventually a branch of it being our law firm under the Inclusive Education Project. So under the podcast, we really aim to start a conversation. So similar to what our presentations were doing, starting a conversation about anything and everything in the realm of children with unique needs and what that means, and pushing for more than just awareness of disabilities, really striving for an understanding, because we feel that once there's an understanding, then we don't have the seclusion. We don't have these awful stories of kiddos not getting what they need in order to learn, right, at a basic level. On the other hand, we also have our law firm on an inclusive education project where we provide low bono and pro bono. Low bono meaning that it's at a reduced cost, and pro bono means for free. So we're able to provide that through the funding that we get through donations from people, so that we're able to review records and see if we can file complaints on behalf of these students. And my background, I obviously went to Whittier Law School, met Amanda. I was going to my third year. She was going into her second year. And we had studied abroad in Spain. And we wanted to see if we could get like a class together. And she had told me about the children's clinic that we had at our law school. So I was like, okay, I can add two units, not a big deal. They quickly took me from the Los Angeles sector all over to the Orange County because I speak Spanish. So the class that we wanted, we actually ended up not even getting together, but we didn't need that. We obviously kept in contact. And like Amanda said, you know, a few years out of law school, we kind of came together and wanted to do special education law in a different way. One of the things that people always notice right off the bat is they're just like, oh, you're so passionate. And it really just stems from being excited about this area of the law. It's so different. It's so new. It's only been around since the 70s, and it really allowed us to be creative and collaborative and pushing the envelope if we needed to by, you know, filing complaints. I have a cousin that is on the spectrum. So my kind of introduction to kiddos with special needs or different learning needs was a bit different. And so when Amanda had suggested, I thought, oh, that's interesting. I went to law school to be an environmental law attorney, and I'm dating myself here, but it was very Erin Brockovich of me wanting to do that. And although I had a fellowship my third year, it was a lot of paperwork. And although I do enjoy writing, the clinic really, you know, took my people pleasing, oh my goodness, Floydian slip, people kind of being a people person, and to be able to use my Spanish speaking skills in a way that would affect change.
Amazing. And change you guys are making and creating and supporting, and passion for sure. And we need more of that. Absolutely. And the kiddos benefit from the service that you guys provide. And inclusion being in your name and in what you have spoken about, what in your view should full inclusion in the classroom look like and feel like for students with disabilities? You know, that's a big kind of a word that we're hearing a lot of, and I'd love to hear what that would look like and feel like from your perspective.
Yes. So when we think about education as a whole, we think about preparing children for the outside world, right? The community, the world, life outside of school. And the world is not, well, there are many parts of the world. It is still segregated. There's segregation all over. But in the grand scheme, we're not, you know, isolating people with disabilities to, you know, one apartment complex or one community or one state or one city. We are all integrated, especially in the United States. And so, and not just students who have identified disabilities, right? We have, all students are different in their strengths and weaknesses. You know, I myself, when I was a student, I was very good at math. I was a math kid. I was not good with English. I did not like reading. You know, that's why I didn't want to go to law school, you know. So everyone has their strengths and weaknesses. So when we think about inclusive education, we really want to think about the whole classroom, the whole child, and every child. So not just the children, you know, with IEPs, with identified disabilities. It's really looking at how can we incorporate better strategies and best practices that can benefit all children, so that they're all included and they're given the same opportunities to be learning from the general education curriculum, that they're having the opportunities to learn from each other, right? That they're not just learning about other students, but they're learning with the other students, and that they are becoming friends with other students that are maybe different from them. The same way we would look at it with race, religion, gender, we should be looking at it from that perspective. So if we can start there, then we can find multiple modalities that can support unique learners. And it doesn't just help the one student with the IEP, it generally helps the rest of the population. And it makes learning more fun if we're being more creative in that way.
I love how you partner that language with race and gender and, you know, including everything together. Let me ask you, what is a question? And I know that we were talking about, you know, kids that haven't been identified and kids that have been identified, but just from kind of a special education lens, what is a question a parent can ask regarding a student placement? So if, as a parent, I'm at an IEP table and I want to know what that placement is going to look like for my kiddo, what can I ask? Should I ask that maybe I don't know to ask?
I think
we're not making an assumption.
Right. I think what's difficult about asking a question is that they have their answer. You know, this is not the first IEP that they're going to. So I would really, the question would be like, I need to see it. I need to observe it. Because oftentimes, you know, we'll get parents and they'll say, well, you know, they wanted Sarah to go into this special day class, you know, for instance, in preschool. And it was just, it's going to be so small and it's going to be this and it's going to be that and da, da, da. And, you know, they come to us because preschool special day very quickly turned into kindergarten special day. And then they're on this track for special day, right, throughout their whole educational career. And really the law indicates that we should stay in the least restrictive environment. And if we're looking at placement as, you know, a line, you're starting with the least restrictive environment, which is a general education placement. The child is with typical peers and they're learning from them, the modeling and the curriculum. Maybe some supports and services are added, that's being pulled out or push in, whatever. When we go more restrictive, we go into a special day class, and that's just children with special needs that may either have a curriculum that is at a slower pace. Oftentimes it is a smaller classroom. Maybe there's more aides, but how they want it to be and how it actually is can be two different things. So I would actually say one of the questions, obviously, as they're telling you what the classroom would look like, would be like, well, I need to see it, because then you can, then the questions will naturally flow. Because in that moment, you're just like, well, this sounds great. It's a smaller classroom and it's this and it's that. Yeah. But is it actually like that?
And maybe I would say not even just ask to look at the special day class, but look at the same grade general education class, because yeah. When we're getting that sales pitch from the IEP team of, this is why this special day class is so wonderful, it's got this, this, and this. If a parent never has the opportunity to see what a gen ed second grade classroom looks like, they don't have that comparison. So in terms of not only like if they're saying we have these small groups, but then like the second grade gen ed class has centers, so they have small groups, it's actually the same. Or there's something so special about the special day class, it's easier for a parent to then imagine, well, could this be done in the gen ed class? Like, you're selling me that this class has this, but, you know, because that's probably the second step is asking, how can this be done in a gen ed class, or can it be?
And that is excellent advice. And I think, you know, from a mama heart, you're going to observe it. And I like how you said, let's look at both scenarios so that you can say, all right, I can really see my child in this scenario, or can I take this component from one scenario and can we put in accommodations, modifications, what type of support so that we can kind of transition or make it work for our kiddo and the least restrictive environment. But from that mama heart, you know your kid the best and you're going to say, yes, this is what, where my kiddo is going to thrive. And mm-hmm. I think by visualizing that mm-hmm. and seeing the interactions with not only the adults inside the classroom, but the adults inside the building, and then also yeah. the children and how the children interact and right. the students interact, and what does transitions look like, and what do, you know, recess look like, and what does lunch look like? And so it provides that opportunity. And I think that's an excellent advice for parents to ask that they may not know that they can even ask, can I go observe what you're trying to sell me that my kiddo should go to, but let me observe and look at it to make sure before you lock me into something that right. then we're on a path that maybe that trajectory isn't the best trajectory for my right. student. And that's maybe not where I envision my student here in the next year, 3 years down the road.
And in our experience, you know, it's very easy for the district to say, oh, no, 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 we can get back in gen ed. But if there is not, yeah, Wendy, you know, yeah, you know, it's easy. No, but that's our experience as well, right? Oh, it's easy, like da, da, da. And, you know, I think that's something else, you know, once you observed and, you know, you're contemplating this, like, what does the gen ed still look like? You know, what is the exposure to gen ed still going to be? You know, have we tried everything? And, you know, that's a tricky question because they're going to say yes, right? And unless you have a little bit of knowledge from just another parent trying something else, it's hard to, you know, do their job for them essentially in providing other things that they should do to keep the child in the least restrictive environment.
And I think it's very hard. And I say this as a parent, I have three boys and my one son has medical needs. He's a brain cancer survivor. And so as a parent, I have the background and I've shared this story before, mm-hmm. and I have the background of a special educator. But man, you get put into that place. It's really hard to emotionally. So to have somebody like you that can provide guidance, mm-hmm. to have, you know, just parents to be a springboard off of is, or, you know, your podcast and just to get information out so that parents have resources, mm-hmm. to know what to ask for.
Yeah. Yeah. Parents want to believe their schools and they want to trust their schools. And, you know, we want that. We want collaboration and trust, but unfortunately it's all top down. So if you have district administrators and Department of Ed saying, this is what we typically do, then you start getting this track of this is the way things are done. And it's not that the IEP team, the teachers may be trying to trick you or trying to tell you the wrong information. Sometimes that's what they're told, or they're told you have to say this, you have to offer this. If, you know, we have schools where if there's a certain diagnosis, they're told you're recommending this class. You know, if a student has a diagnosis of autism, well, we have an autism specific class. That's what's going to be best. And, you know, that sales pitch comes from up above. It comes from administrators. And, you know, when you're in it and you really do want to trust the educators, right? They're the professionals. It's hard to put your take a step back and have that thought of, wait a minute, my gut's telling me something else. Should I be questioning? And it's difficult, I think, in that moment. I mean, me having a child, but not going through the IEP process as a parent, you know, I can't even imagine sitting in those meetings and, you know, the guilt of afterwards thinking I should have asked that. But I, you know, it's kind of like if we're in a doctor's appointment and after we leave, we think, oh, I should have asked that. And we didn't. And there's so much pressure to sign the IEP right then and there and agree right then and there. So we really try to empower parents that, you know what, it's okay if you don't think of questions in that moment. And it's okay if you don't, you know, take a second to trust your gut in that moment. All you need to do is tell the team, I'd like to take this information. I'd like to digest it. Maybe you need to share it with, you know, your co-parent. Maybe you want to share it with a friend, a grandparent, or even just sleep on it. You're allowed to do that. And that's probably the best advice we can give families, because it's that after effect that maybe think about it some more, read it over and read it over too, because a lot of times we hear things verbally in the IEP meetings and they're not giving you the draft with everything there. And a lot is said in an IEP, mm-hmm. but not written down in the IEP. Mm-hmm. And so having this, that trick, I think empowers parents to say, okay, I've got the power to look at this later.
Absolutely.
And, you know, really consider it and then trust my gut if it's telling me something different.
That's right. That's right. So for parents new to special education, what are the key features or aspects that determine a student's need for an IEP versus a 504?
So that's a really good question. I had a potential client that I was explaining this to just yesterday. So when we're looking at the IEP, so they're two separate laws. 504 plans come under the federal law of the Rehabilitation Act, Section 504. And it really calls to these everyday activities that may be affecting, or I'm sorry, the child's disability that is affecting their everyday activities. So really just easy example is your child is in a wheelchair. There are no wheelchair ramps. It is discriminatory if there's no wheelchair ramps by your school. So you could sue under Section 504 to get that remedy. With IEPs that are created from the Individuals with Disability in Education Act, which is also federal law and the law that we primarily deal with, we're looking at these individualized education plans, programs that provide services, that provide a way for the child's unique needs to be properly supported in the least restrictive environment. So there's a lot of buzzwords for IEPs, and we speak in acronyms, but at the end of the day, there are certain accommodations that may be in a Section 504. So oftentimes we'll see kiddos with ADHD have 504 plans, and they have accommodations such as time and a half on tests, maybe for homework, just kind of really simplize things. It's not necessarily changing the curriculum. It's just changing the way the child is performing to a certain extent, right? Whereas IEPs, there is the option to modify the curriculum, to have these bigger accommodations that would show that, okay, well, instead of him doing the 100 problems on the math test, it's, you know, 50 or whatever. Or the modification would be, you know, there's 10 spelling words. These are what all the second graders get. I'm going to take some of these out and put some first grade words to modify that for this particular child. So while we see also 13 eligibility categories, there's just so many more things that are spelled out for IEPs and the IDEA, whereas Section 504 is a bit broader and you're able to get kind of some of those key accommodations that we see.
The different laws have different criteria. So Section 504 has different criteria for eligibility than the IDEA for eligibility. Yeah. And it's typically a higher threshold for an IEP to qualify than it is a 504. And so that's where sometimes teens get into trouble. They think a student with ADHD or a medical need only qualifies for a 504. And they'll say that. They'll say, we don't think you qualify for an IEP, you only qualify for a 504, but no assessment's been done. That's probably the first big problem, is that typically eligibility for either, an assessment needs to be done to determine eligibility. It's not just a suspicion that a teen or a parent has. Typically, we need to go through assessments.
What would you guide parents if they're suspecting that there is some sort of disability or something impacting their student in the classroom? What kind of guidance would you provide them in terms of reaching out to the school to seek to kind of start that eligibility process?
So the first thing that has to be done,
pushback, right? Like they're going to come to you and say, look, the school said there's nothing wrong, but I'm seeing X, Y, and Z. What do I do?
So a lot of parents will say, I'd like to talk about getting an IEP, or I'd like to talk about getting a 504. You need to back up, ask for an assessment. Because that's when you get the pushback, is like, oh, I don't think you qualify or whatnot, or the process gets delayed. But if you put in writing that you want an assessment for an IEP, the school district then has an obligation to assess right away. So that's going to be the trigger point. But we do recommend they put it in writing. And it's almost like anyone that you have email addresses for, or anyone you can, you know, submit it in mail for, send it. So like if you have your teacher, your principal, your, you know, counselor at the school, if you have someone from the district, as many people. So that way there's no question about whether or not the district got it.
And what is the timeline once they, well, two parts to this question for folks, the letter can be written by a parent. Is that correct?
So yeah. So California is specific, and each state has like different case law that has created the law. So in California, technically speaking, even if you're having a conversation with the teacher or somebody at the district, they are supposed to help you put the request in writing. So the example that Amanda gave, them kind of pushing it off, that happens way more often than what that law actually states, which is you, if they're coming to you and they're talking to you about this, you help them put it in writing. So for California, once you put it in writing, the school district will then generate a assessment plan to have to assess the child. If they do not do that, they must provide the parent with a prior written notice as to why they are not going to assess. But more often than not, that triggering of that written kind of, I've been seeing these issues, I feel like my child needs to be assessed for special education, you know, kind of having those key words, you know, in reading or writing. If you want to give examples, that's great. But you really just have to say, I'd like my child to be assessed for special education. That's when in California, we have these kind of specific timelines of when they need to be providing the assessment plan, which I always mix up. It's either 15 days or 10 days.
It's 15 days to provide the assessment plan in California. The federal law says a reasonable time. So other jurisdictions, other states have, there's a few states I think that do 15 days, some that do 30. I think the case law across the board is like anything between 30 and 60 is considered could be reasonable, but anything like past that is not reasonable. And of course, like summers and winter break don't count.
And so the 10 days is once you have the assessment plan, you have 10 days to sign, to review it, sign it, and return it. Within those 10 days, they give you 10 days in California, because if they just check mark a couple of assessments and you're like, no, wait, I think that there's some speech and language issues, you know, you can, there's typically at the bottom a space where it's like, is there any other areas that you wish your child to be assessed? And the parent can indicate that. And then typically what happens is the district will provide, you know, they'll either agree or provide a prior written notice saying why they don't agree in writing. And then they bring it back to you. And once it is signed here in California and it's returned and the district receives it, they have 60 days to complete all the assessments and hold the IEP meeting. So what Amanda is alluding to is if you're signing that on May 24th and school is out on May 28th, they're not going to start in 4 days. What will likely happen, because there is a break in excess of 10 days, summer, they will begin as they need to begin as soon as possible within the new school year.
Same with if you request an IEP, say in June, they're not going to do the assessment over the summer. They're going to count like the 15 school days as once the school year resumes. Mm-hmm. And then in reality, the federal law says that that 60-day time frame for the assessments is 30 days to do the assessment and then another 30 days to hold the IEP. But a lot of jurisdictions have kind of given a lot of leeway to that to say, well, as long as the IEP, everything's done within the 60 days, we're fine. So we typically say that it's that 60-day time frame to have the assessment done, have the IEP meeting.
Gotcha. Which is, it gets confusing, right? Between states. So, but it's important to have this global understanding or working knowledge of a time frame. Mm-hmm. And I would encourage parents to ask.
Exactly. In that letter.
For the state.
How long will this process take? You know, and put that in the letter, because there should be open communication at that point, right? Especially if the parent is putting it in writing.
That's right. So let me ask, assuming now that the student has an IEP, how can parents go about seeking more data or resources or insights into their child's current levels and progress?
So at any time in the year, a parent can ask for an IEP meeting. You don't have to wait for the annual, you don't have to wait for the triennial. And the school district, once you request an IEP, is required to hold an IEP within 30 days. Doesn't matter the reason, doesn't matter if you just had one. And so you could go to that IEP, you can ask for information, you know, anecdotal, informal information from the teachers and providers. You should be getting your progress reports on a quarterly basis to, you know, give you progress on goals. But there's a lot of things that we might talk about or ask for progress that aren't necessarily in a goal. So, you know, the easiest way is to have that IEP meeting, see if we can get more information. And sometimes you go to the meeting, you ask questions about a certain development of a skill or whatnot, and the team doesn't have the information. So the best way is to say, I would like you to take formal data. Maybe there's a behavior that's popped up that there's not a goal for. Maybe there's not a behavior plan. And we want to see if that meets, maybe a parent says, I think that we need a goal in this area. Taking data is the best way to determine whether or not a goal is needed or more services. If it's been over a year since your last assessment, you can always ask for an assessment. You don't have to wait for the triennial every 3 years. The assessments can be done every year. you know, if there's like,
and especially if there's something new, you know, they will typically wait until the triennial if everything is still the same. But if typically what we'll tell parents is just to say, you know, you're seeing something new. So that's why within a year you believe that an assessment should happen. So.
You're entering a new school. Maybe you went from elementary school to middle school, school to high school. Or something new comes up, or, you know, there's just several areas, you know, we're seeing this a lot now with kids where there's been so much going from virtual to in-person, back to virtual, back to in-person. So that can create a lot of changes. So maybe saying, let's take some informal data isn't enough because there's like six areas we want to look at, you know, a full formal assessment is going to be the best way. So like we said, if it's been more than a year, you can ask for that assessment anytime. You can ask for an IEP meeting anytime. And you can also ask for data. If maybe you're thinking, I want to have an IEP meeting, but I'd like them to be prepared. You can request that IEP. And we recommend doing that in writing. And you say, look, I want to know how my student is doing in X, Y, and Z area. Can you take some data before this meeting? Because the meeting is going to be in 30 days. That gives you 30 days to take data. That way you're not saying, okay, let's wait 30 days for an IEP. And then we ask about the data. Then they take data over the next, and then next thing we know, we're 3 months later. So if you're able to prepare the team for what you want to talk about and ask them to gather data, you can always do that as well.
Excellent. And excellent. So what do you say if you come to an IEP and your present level does not have data in it, which is a huge no-no, but yeah, I've seen it happen.
Yep.
Or a parent does not receive their quarterly progress notes.
Yeah, that happens a lot. So it's typically something that they're not prepared. So we're not going to have this IEP meeting, right? That can be like the forceful way of doing it, especially if you expected that information. Oftentimes, however, what we like to do, especially if there's assessments, we request that a draft of everything that will be discussed at the IEP meeting be presented to us at least 5 days before the IEP meeting so that the parent has some time to read it over, digest. We do this for a couple different reasons. One, it's so much easier to take your time reading over this stuff than having somebody just read it word for word and waste everybody's time. We can all read, we can all figure it out. You give it to us beforehand. It's more time efficient. And for those people that have just different ways of digesting information, or your partner's not going to be there and they might have questions that they can write, it's just a better way of doing it. There's nothing in the law that says that it needs to be provided before the IEP, but we believe it's best practice for the team, for the reasons that we stated, to request it. Do we get it 24 hours, maybe a couple hours before the IEP meeting? Yes. Are those meetings that we get it 5 days before, do they go a lot more quickly and efficiently and everybody's on the same page? Absolutely, yes. So that would be kind of one of the things that we would encourage, so that you don't just show up and they don't have the present levels or they don't have the progress reports that they're providing to you.
And, you know, it's always important to remember a parent is a member, an equal member and participant of the IEP team. So when we talk about, you know, there's always that question box on the IEP that says, do you consider yourself a participant, an active participant? Were your, you know, suggestions considered or whatnot? If you feel like you need that information, you need to be able to process that information ahead of time and read it ahead of time and you weren't given it, then technically you weren't considered part of the IEP process, because if you're not able to, in that moment, provide feedback or ask questions, then you're really not contributing in a way that you could. So we get a lot of teams that like to ask why are you asking for something? So if you do ask for the documentation ahead of time and they ask you why, you know, that's kind of your reasoning, is that you want to be able to be prepared, to be able to provide feedback, to be able to contribute. And especially if you have one of those teams where they're trying to fit in IEPs between the bell ringing at the end of the day and an hour later when teachers have to be let go. So we have a 45 minute window or a 50 terrible. Or a 60 minute, you know, terrible. if we know we're only going to have that set time, if everybody could have, and especially like a lot of times I have parents that are really collaborative with teachers where like they've already talked about the goals ahead of time. So it's just a matter of making sure that if we want to collaborate between, you know, speech and the teacher, then they're having that conversation, but we're not reading word for word every goal and saying, do we need to change these things? So, you know, giving that feedback of, you know, I want to be able to come prepared. I want to be able to ask questions ahead of time. I want to make sure. Like,
Amanda and I are having IEP meetings when a progress report should come out, right? Like when we're kind of monitoring. And it's unfortunate, we shouldn't have to, but oftentimes that's the only way we get the information right. on the benchmark is that, you know, we made a change in December. Amanda and I put it a task on that case. Okay, we're going to, in February, ask for an IEP meeting in early March. And the purpose is to check in on progress because essentially getting that progress report and seeing whether or not the child is making progress on that benchmark, you should be able to come to an IEP meeting. And if the goal needs to change, if additional services need to happen, they should. You don't have to wait a year for all the benchmarks to say, no, no, no. And then, oh, look, they didn't pass the goal. You know, it's okay to change things. And I think what's helpful when you get those progress reports as well, and why it's important, why you want to say that you want it, is because you want to, across all settings, have the child be able to write their name. So if you're at the kitchen table with your child and they can't write their name, and that's a one-to-one setting, it's usually less distracting. Some would argue more distracting because they're at home. But I think that after the couple years that we've had, parents were at an advantage when they weren't completely overwhelmed to really see how their child learned and whether they were learning or not. And so even though pre-COVID, we'd always say, hey, take a look at the goals. Do you feel like your child is able to complete these goals? See if they can, because then that's your own data that you're bringing, right? That you're saying, I don't think that this is independent. I don't think that this is happening across all settings, because if they can only do it in the classroom setting, the real world is not a classroom, right? They That's need right. to be yeah. able to have these skills and the longevity of those skills. Otherwise, you're seeing that goal 2 or 3 years down the road. And it's like, if they mastered it, we shouldn't be seeing it 2, 3 years down the road.
That's right. So how much data should parents expect to receive regarding their child's progress?
So it depends on the goal and how the goal's written.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, if it's not an assessment year, you're not doing an assessment, you're not going to get, you know, like full testing measures. But, you know, what we like to say is if the IEP was held on a Thursday and the IEP team is coming to you with one opportunity that Tuesday and one opportunity that mm-hmm. Wednesday, that's mm-hmm. not sufficient at yeah. all. Because the idea is that the goal should have been worked on the entire year. Mm-hmm. And to just see progress over 2 days or 3 days. We want to see consistent progress. So what I would say is that if the goal was worked on throughout the course of the year, in reality, every time that goal was worked on, there should have been a data point. Mm-hmm. So if we're doing it in an SAI time or a speech time, and that's happening once a week, twice a week, mm-hmm. you know, there's 40 weeks in a school year, there should be 40 data points. Right. So in reality, that's how it should look. Now, is that how it happens? You know, a lot of times we get progress reports or we get the goal reports and it'll say a percentage. So it'll say the goal was for 80%. We're at 70%. Mm-hmm. What parents don't realize that 70% had to come from somewhere.
Right.
And if it's just an estimate, that's a problem. So what we recommend is if you're not sure if that 70% is accurate, if you think your child can do it more or less, ask for the raw data that correlates with that 70%. And if they cannot produce that data, there's no proof that that goal was actually met or not met. And I've had teams try to tell me that that information, just like work samples, gets shredded, you know, after like a month or so. Well, that's not appropriate. Like they should never do that. But so don't be afraid to ask for the raw data, because we should be taking data. Just like if you're concerned, if a speech session is happening every week, maybe you've seen the speech teacher out a lot and you're like, is this really happening? Or the child comes home and says, yeah, I didn't see that teacher this week. You can always ask for service logs. The team is supposed to be collecting data and having actual like logs of the service minutes to make sure that the IEP is being implemented appropriately. And then also those data points to see the progress. And you should be able to see progress reporting, like the actual raw data, every time that there's a progress report too. Right. So you can always ask for it during that progress.
It should exist.
You know, because
so it should,
right, it should,
you know,
exist.
It should be readily available when, you know, it's not. And I think even just taking a step back, when you're creating the goals, what is 4 out of 5 trials? What is a trial? Sometimes I've had teachers say a trial is like 3 separate assignments or something, right? Or we'll get like the best, which is like 80% in 4 out of 5 trials over 2 weeks. And it's like, whoa, 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 whoa. There's like 3 different things here. Okay. If we're looking for mastery, we want the 80%. Awesome. So let's have that 80% over 2 weeks, or we want it 4 out of 5 trials over 2 weeks.
The 80% and ask how many opportunities.
Right, right.
How many opportunities occur in a session or in a week?
Right.
Because that's important too. Because like if we're talking about social skills and there's only one opportunity every week or one opportunity every day, then that's going to be important, right? If you have an opportunity every day to work on a skill, then asking for 70% across 2 or 3 weeks, that's probably appropriate because then right. we're dealing with 10 or 15 right. opportunities, right? But if it only happens once a week, because we're talking about in a speech setting that happens once a week, and we're saying we want 70% across 2 weeks, is that? No, it might need to be across a month, you know? So asking those questions about when the opportunities are is going to be important to figuring out if those data points are appropriate.
That's excellent advice. Just asking those, you know, when is it? What does it look like? Amanda, you had mentioned a little ways back about behavior and behavior intervention plans. You kind of alluded to that. Can you explain the purpose of a BIP, behavior intervention plan for parents, and what are some common interventions that might be used?
Yeah. So typically when we're dealing with any types of behavior, and behavior could mean inattention, it could mean elopement out of the classroom, it could mean aggressive behaviors. A lot of times teams think of behavior as just maladaptive behaviors, are hitting, screaming, kicking, yelling, tantruming. But behavior encompasses being inattentive. So a child could be just sitting and not paying attention to what's being said. That's a behavior. They could refuse to get started on their work. That's a behavior. So when there's behaviors that occur, oftentimes they occur across the school day. So it's not something that we're just going to work on in language arts or we're going to work on in speech or whatnot. So it's something that needs to be addressed throughout the day. So the best way to address it throughout the day is to have a behavior plan. So it's encompassing a little bit more than just a goal, saying we're going, it includes goals, of course, but we're not just saying, okay, we're going to improve this behavior. It's a plan that allows us to take specific data about a behavior, the antecedents of the behavior, and what type of supports are we providing, what types of reinforcements, and what replacement behaviors we're expecting and how we're teaching that behavior. Because oftentimes when we're addressing behaviors, we need to use consistent language, consistent prompting, and consistent support across settings. So the best way to do that is to make sure that everyone is on the same page. So we have this plan that says for the targeted behaviors, maybe for a student are elopement out of their seat. Maybe it's, you know, attending to tasks. So the child maybe starts the assignment, but has to be prompted to get back on task 10 times. So the goal is to get it to be where they're more independent, that they're attending to task more, something along those lines. Those are the replacement behaviors that we want to see. So we need to be taking data. And sometimes it's about looking at what is working better. So the plan should be flexible. It should be tweaked as needed throughout the school year, because sometimes we see that first we have to figure out like, why is the behavior occurring? And sometimes that's from data collection, but then also are there interventions that are working better than others? And what are those interventions? So the plan is going to encompass all of these things, and it allows some type of behavior specialist to be training the other staff members that are with the student all day, whether they have an aide or not, the teacher, any other service providers that are with them. And then of course, the data collection that comes with all of that.
And is that something you can have written into the IEP for supports or training for interventions to be modified at home?
So certainly, a lot of families have home behavior specialists that we prefer if they collaborate with the school team, because just like we want to use the same interventions throughout the school day, it's the best if we could use the same interventions home to school. So if we're using certain language and certain prompting, we have reinforcement charts or systems. If we have visuals, using them the same, the exact same, using the same language across settings is going to be best. So if the school team creates a behavior plan, absolutely, it's going to be attached to the IEP, and we want to share it with the family. And if there's a home team, you know, they can collaborate as well. And then there should be regular communication where if the home team or even the parent starts using an intervention, they're like, you know what, this is working wonders. Of course, we want to have that collaboration between home and school.
So at what point should a parent seek legal advice or outside advocacy for their child's special education needs?
I mean, we usually get parents who are mad. So they get to a point where they're, you know, frustrated, they're mad. I think that it doesn't hurt to speak to somebody that knows the ins and outs. You know, special education law, like I said, is pretty young compared to something like contract law, right? Which has been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. But, you know, I think it's your child. You're going to be very emotional and passionate, as you should be. And sometimes it's easier to be able to speak to somebody with an expertise in this area, even if you're just kind of like, oh, I wonder if even if things are good, like you might just want to talk to someone just to make sure, you know, maybe you do want a little bit of extra support in, you know, X, Y, and Z, and it'd be worth it. But like I said, oftentimes parents, something's happened. There's a sticking point. The district wants to take away services. District wants to move placements. It's some type of change, or the district just kind of pushing parents' concerns to the wayside, and, you know, parents have had enough. So, you know, they go to Google, they go to their other parents that they know who have sued or have used an attorney. And then that's how they kind of end up to us. Sometimes, I mean, we have teachers, you know, under the table kind of, you know, giving our cards to parents because they know that they can only do so much to advocate for the child. Right. Outside support needs to be provided.
And it doesn't have to mean that just because you go to an advocate or an attorney that you have to sue, especially the way that we represent our clients. We try to do as much collaborative work with the IEP teams as possible, because most of the time you're with that school or that school district for quite a bit, especially if you're their kids. So, and even if you're just going to be for that year, like it's better to have a collaborative relationship if we can, you know, so we always say like, trust your mom gut or your dad gut. If you feel like something's not right, even if you can't articulate what it is, you just think that something's not working, you know, you can always talk to an attorney and, you know, just let them know how you're feeling. And generally they can say, I mean, when we have parents talk to us, like most of the time we're saying, this may not help you, but, and sometimes this isn't the first time I've heard it in this school district. So sometimes just being able to hear that you're not alone, you're not the only one going through it, I think can help. Because I tell my clients all the time, like, because a lot of times they think, I should have come to you sooner. I should have done something sooner. I should have said something. And they blame themselves. And we always say, no, you're the best parent you can be for your child. You are doing the best that you can. You are working with what you know. And at the end of the day, you're talking to me now. And that's what's important. And even if it comes like, and why we created the podcast was that there's so much that parents can do on their own without even needing an attorney to be, you know, at the front or the face of the communication. There's a lot that parents can do if they just understand what their rights are and are empowered to do so. So, you know, sometimes, you know, don't feel like you need an attorney, but also don't feel like just because you get an attorney that it's going to end up in a lawsuit, because that can be scary for people.
That's right. That's right. Let's talk a little bit about compensatory service here in the world of the pandemic and students being online and back in school and back at home and, you know, monitoring progress and needs being met or not met. What's your take on that?
So just to back up, compensatory education is going to be an equitable form of remedy. And so we usually see two types. We see the in-kind, which is educational services. It's probably the most that we see, you know, what service did your child not receive, you know, because the speech and language pathologist was out on leave unexpectedly, right? And then we have out-of-pocket or reimbursement, where the parent has provided outside tutoring, outside counseling, outside speech and language, outside OT that they would like to have reimbursed. A lot of times we're dealing with the child has not made progress on their IEP goals. Maybe their grades are low. Their state testing is low. So the child has not gained an educational benefit. And they require compensatory education to try and make them whole again. So it would either be that example of like, maybe they actually missed a certain amount of speech and language, or in this time, the child regressed. And the child regressed because of the transitions, virtual to in-person to back, you know, maybe the types of services that the district had provided just were not enough. And because
the quality
did not make progress on their goals, now they require compensatory education, which could be something different. Maybe it's just one-to-one tutoring. Maybe it's a reading service that's outside of the school. Compensatory education can also be provided by the school in the form of maybe the teacher working with the child more, adding speech and language sessions. But typically, by the time it gets to us, we seek it from a non-public agency. So an agency that's certified by the California Department of Education to provide these services because they meet certain criteria. So that's where we're with compensatory education. Compensatory education in the world of COVID is very interesting because, and I'll have Amanda go into it a little bit, but what we've been seeing is essentially the way that the governor had kind of written out what was supposed to happen was that when kiddos came back, even if it needed to be evaluations, the IEP teams needed to have a conversation about whether the child had regressed or not and whether compensatory education needed to be provided. We didn't see that. We're not.
Yeah. So yeah, when we're looking at comp ed for COVID related issues, we're looking mostly at two different reasons. One, the IDEA never changed. There were no waivers or anything during COVID. So during distance learning, the IEP was meant to be implemented fully. So if a student received 200 minutes of specialized academic instruction a week, the student received 200 minutes of specialized academic instruction a week, the same quality that they would have in person. Now, virtually, we know for a majority of students, not only did this not happen, but it was impossible for many of these students because they either shut the computer, they walked away from the computer. If it wasn't in person, it wasn't going to work, right? So the idea of if there was something in your IEP that just was flat out not provided or the student couldn't access it. So that situation where the provider's there, right? They're on the screen, right, but the child walked away. They didn't access that. So that needs to be made up. So if there were 200 minutes a week and the student didn't receive zero and there were 40 weeks in that whole school year that you had virtual, then that's a lot of minutes, right? So that's the first step, is that those need to be made up. What Vicky was referring to about the regression was that federally, not only did the IEDA not change, but we're always supposed to look at whether or not there's regression for a student, no matter what. But certainly the Department of Education had guidance to say that once we returned in person, that was the school district's opportunity to sit there and say, which of these students regressed and how much did they regress during the distance learning period? And this wasn't supposed to be like if a parent asked for it. This was supposed to be something that every IEP team did and talked about regression for every single student. I will tell you, when the amount of IEP teams that did that without me asking was probably two. I did not have very many.
I had one and it was in January, like too little too late. Like,
so had a couple that said we need to do an assessment, which was appropriate. The Department of Ed said, if we get to the point where we just don't know how much regression, an assessment's appropriate, that's totally fine.
Absolutely.
But the school has an obligation to look at that regression and then provide compensatory education. Because the idea is that we need to be putting these students back in the position that they should have been had none of this happened. And you know, I've gotten a lot of pushback from schools being like, well, COVID wasn't our fault. Distance learning wasn't our fault. Our governor having schools closed or having mandates wasn't our fault. But guess what? Doesn't matter. The IDEA, the federal law, never got any waivers. Some congressional members tried to change that. It didn't go through. Congress said, no, the IDEA has to stand no matter what, which means that it doesn't matter. Especially because the school districts across the board in all 50 states received additional funding to support not only appropriate specialized learning, but in many states they gave for in-person, because there were certain students who needed mental health or behavioral supports in person, even during the height of COVID and distance learning. And schools, some schools provided it, but some did not. So in terms of like whether or not it was the school's fault, like there was a lot of time. Like we talk about the March 2020 to June 2020 was kind of that period where everyone was feeling it out, trying to figure out what was going to go on. How can we provide this virtual, right? And I don't want to say we gave them a pass during that time because they still had an obligation. But certainly during that time, there was a level of understanding that things were going to be tough. Let's figure this out. The minute we got to September, and then we ended up having a full, almost a full year where most students were virtual, there was no excuse. There was plenty of time for school teams to figure out how they can. And, you know, we have talked to many professionals who have come up with ways that their program could be virtual and students could thrive. Even the students with the most inattentive behaviors could thrive. So we know that it's possible, but it didn't happen. There was not any innovative work happening for many of these students. And so for that, the students are entitled to compensatory education. So almost every student on an IEP, unfortunately, most of them did regress over COVID. So almost every student should be entitled to compensatory education. And then I don't say every, because there were students that being at home, that level of decreased anxiety did sometimes allow them to thrive. So it's going to be a case by case individual basis. It's going to be something the IEP team needs to look at, whether it's through assessments or not, but that should be owed to most students.
And there's two things that I want to add that Amanda had mentioned. One, if you did not agree to make changes to your IEP, what a lot of districts did was they held that IEP in April, May, and they changed the services that they were providing. Now, whether that was okay or not, if you agreed, parties are mutually agreeing. And we get this a lot because parents are like, well, I understood it was COVID, and that's okay. You know, we were only doing what we thought was best because we didn't know. So I don't want parents hearing this and being like, oh, shoot, I agreed to go from 200 to 40 minutes and I shouldn't have it. No, because we don't know what would have happened and the quality of that. So don't beat yourself up on that. Your child may have still regressed because of a reduction in services. And that's something that still would need to be, you know, evaluated or whatnot. The second thing, and oh, I had it in my mind, but I lost it. But I didn't want parents to feel like, oh my goodness, like I didn't think of that. Like what's going on? And if the second thing comes to me, I'll come back. But
we're still in it. It's not too late.
We're still
just
in it.
Because it's been almost 2 years since the start of COVID. We have a 2-year statute of limitations. So if we're talking about the majority of COVID, you still have time to seek this compensatory education. It's not something that once the school year is over or once you're back in person, if you didn't do it, you do still have time. But we do say that because you only have 2 years set limitations for that first part of COVID, the March through June, we are coming close on the set limitations for that period of time. So if you think you're entitled to compensatory education, the first step is talk to your IEP team, say, I believe we're owed. If they say no, then it's time to talk to an attorney.
Oh, I remember now. So the stimulus funding, right? What I saw at the beginning of the school year was that a lot of districts were offering to all students. So tutoring for all students, intensive reading programs for all students. Awesome. Great. Good job using the stimulus money for that. However, if your child has an IEP, what is that? It's an individualized education program or plan. So even if you took advantage of that, that still may not have been specialized to fit the unique needs of your child. So even if you did not partake it, they can't throw that in your face and say, well, we offered this and you didn't want it. Was it tailored to meet my child's unique needs? No.
Right.
And so I am still entitled to it. So that was something else that we've seen that we wanted to make parents aware of.
And just to ask that question of let's have this conversation about compensatory ed and how can we tailor it to the unique needs of my child.
Exactly.
And their specific needs. And also asking for an assessment or an evaluation if there's a need for it. And I think those are little nuggets that parents may not necessarily know that they could ask for.
Right.
Yeah. And I think sometimes that assessment is important because I have seen some schools this school year that have decreased expectations.
Yes.
So what I mean by that is a student who is starting third grade, some of these teachers were told by their administrators, well, they basically missed all of their second grade year. So we're just going to like do second grade content standards. So how do we determine if that student actually regressed? If we're doing the same thing over, maybe they're a twice exceptional student. They're very bright and they can handle it. So then it looks like they're doing good. So if you look at whether or not they've regressed, we're not looking at what's happening in the classroom, because what's happening in the classroom could be repetition. We're talking about what should be happening in the classroom. So if they're in third grade, we're talking about, are they meeting third grade expectations or not, not second grade.
I love that. So as we're kind of winding down our conversation, what should I have asked you guys that I didn't know enough to ask?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Oh, that's a good question.
I think one of the things is additional like tips or tricks. And this is how we start some of our presentations. And Amanda has already kind of said a couple of them. You know, you don't have to sign the IEP right away. If they're wanting to implement services, obviously the sooner that you sign the IEP, the sooner that the services start. But just take a beat, pause, right? As Brené Brown would say, you know, just Brené Brown. Yes. I don't know. Yeah. Who am I quoting? Yeah. Pause. Yes. So that's also very useful. And, you know, bring a friend to the IEP to take notes, because you're not, I mean, as much as you want to take notes, and sometimes I'm really good at taking notes simultaneously, but you're in the moment, have somebody come with you. Being, well, on Zoom now, it's a little better, but pre-COVID, you know, you go into the IEP meeting room, there's 12 people on the district side, and there's just you. If your partner doesn't come, bring a friend, have them come so that they could take notes. Yeah.
And one last thing that I would say, and it's even more, we say this all the time, but it's even more prevalent during COVID, is that special education and IEPs are not just for students with disabilities. It's a misconception that that's the case. It is any student who's has any kind of impairment, whether it's known or not, that is impacting their education. And one of the most common ones is mental health issues. Mm-hmm. A student might not have a diagnosis of depression. Mm-hmm. They're struggling emotionally. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times parents think, my child doesn't have autism. They don't have Down syndrome. They don't have ADHD. So they don't qualify for special education. If your child is struggling in school, and it's not because, you know, they aren't going, you know, for whatever reason, students who are going through medical treatment and they're in the hospital a lot, that might not be a obvious, you know, disability, but they qualify for special education because that those absences are impacting their education and their access to their education. Maybe a student is in foster care and they're going from home to home. So they're going from school to school. That is something that impacts their education. It is some kind of impairment that impacts their education. So, you know, it doesn't have to be something where it's one of those, you know, really obvious disabilities. If there's something impacting your child's education and they're struggling, if all else fails, you go and do an assessment with the school district and they say, you know what, there's a few areas where we can help and here's some things we can help with, but they don't qualify for an IEP. Mm-hmm. No harm done. Mm-hmm. At the worst, you find out more information. Information is gold in special education. So just know that it's not so limited as I think a lot of people think.
And that's really important to know, because you're absolutely right. There's a lot of times parents just assume that there's not a qualification. So
right.
I will put all of this information in my show notes in terms of how to find your podcast. But before we leave, I want to ask just one final question. If you guys had a billboard with one tip for parents, what would it be and why?
That's a good one too. Now I'm thinking about a billboard and like what I would like. I guess it's not even a tip. It's just like, especially over these last 3 years, I think what parents need to hear is that you're doing the best that you can. And impossible
trust your
circumstances.
Yep.
Yeah. In impossible circumstances, you are doing the best that you can with the information that you have. You have not damaged your kids. You are trying to survive. We're not here to thrive during the pandemic. We're here to survive.
Right.
So that would be, it's not necessarily a tip, but I feel like parents need to hear that more than ever.
They do. It's so true. Yeah. It is so true. And trust your gut. Both of those are amazing. And I can't thank you enough. I mean, I could sit here forever and just chit chat. And
we've already gone over time.
Yes, I know. You guys have just added so much beautiful tips and information, and I really appreciate all of the time that you guys have given and input that you have shared. So thank you so much for being a part of this today. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for having us.
You bet. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today for our Special Ed Strategist podcast. To hear more pro tips and find additional IEP essentials, including our IEP webinar, please visit www.learningessentialsedu.com.